So today's talk, I'm calling The Role of Repentance in Buddhism. And this is another talk that was inspired by somebody submitting a Dharma question to me. So hopefully we'll keep the little link in the newsletter for submitting Dharma questions because they're giving me great material to cover for you. So, yeah, somebody asked about the role of repentance. If you attended our chanting, well, no, not this morning because we did a founder ceremony, which is different. But if you, oh, that reminds me, I was gonna say a little bit of something about Kyogen because we did a founder's ceremony for him today. So, yes, so today was September 25th, and we did our annual founders ceremony in honor of what we say is the honorary founder of our temple, Kyogen Carlson. He was one of my teachers. My ordination teacher is Gyokuko Carlson, his wife. But he basically, if you studied at Dharmaring Zen Center like I did, you kind of during my era anyway, you got both teachers as a package if you signed up. So yeah, I Kyogen, he passed, he was only, ooh, I'm forgetting, but I think only in his mid-60s and passed away from a heart attack in 2014. And he was, you know, it feels like way, way too soon. Feel like somebody who he just had so much more to give and so much more to do. And I'll often end up with some kind of Dharma question, and I'll just think, you know, what would Kyogen say? He had a masterful way with the Dharma, which is now quite wonderfully accessible to all of you through a book. You Are Still Here, which we've actually used in our classes. There's Mark, thank you very much. You Are Still Here. And that is a compilation of talks that he gave, and Bob's got it too. That was put together by one of his students, Sally Jiko Tisdale, and she did a masterful job of piecing that all together for us. So you get a good taste of him through that book. And yeah, so he very strong influence on our lineage. He had a way of holding the Dharma. I mean, like our little chant today said, he had deep Zen, very, very deep understanding and faith in the practice, but it was never the slightest bit pretentious. He just carried himself with this down to earth ordinariness, and could be goofy. And could be lighthearted, never not somebody who invited projections at all. And I think that's a just a wonderful lesson and indicator to the way that our lineage in particular holds the Dharma, which is we take it very, very seriously, but we also try to just be ordinary people and have a sense of humor and be relaxed enough that people feel like they can join us and not make the Dharma intimidating, not make you feel like it, like you don't belong. So just felt like I should say a couple words about Kyogen. All right, so on to today's topic. If you come to our regular Sunday chanting service, you will hear us. The first thing that we do after bows is chant our karma verse three times. So we chant all harmful karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, I now atone for it all. And in case you have any doubt about what this verse means, because it doesn't really mention repentance per se, there's more explanation of this verse in our Kyoju Kaimon, which is our precept scriptures. So our precepts are the moral guide, our moral guidelines that we take as Zen Buddhists. So if you have the chant book, this is on page 27, if you care to look at it. And it says, because of their limitless compassion, the Buddhas and Dharma ancestors have flung wide the gates of compassion to all living things. Although karmic consequence is inevitable at some point in the three periods of time, contrition brings freedom and immaculacy. As this is so, let us be utterly contrite before the Buddhas. May the Buddhas and ancestors have compassion upon us. Help us see the obstacle of suffering we have inherited from the limitless past, and lead us in such a way that we share the merit that fills the universe. For they in the past were as we are now, and we will be as they in the future. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. A contrite heart is open to the Dharma and finds the gateway to the precepts clear and unobstructed. Bearing this in mind, we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and make this act of contrition wholeheartedly. So it's actually an oversight on my part that this contains a different translation of the karma verse than the one that we chant in service. The one that we chant in service I borrowed from Great Bao Zen Monastery, and this is a more traditional Dharmarain version. And I kind of like this one that's in the Kyoju Kaimon a little better. Particularly, I like, well, I'll talk about the words later, but a vow versus a tone. So it says the Buddhas and Dharma ancestors have flung wide the gates of compassion to all living things. So are we confessing to the Buddhas and Dharma ancestors? Did they hold the power of forgiveness like a priest in the Catholic Church? Contrition brings freedom and immaculacy. For many modern Western convert Buddhists, which most of us are, this line can be quite unnerving. Stinking of the view in some Christian traditions that we are by nature sinners, and we need to surrender to the grace of God or Jesus for salvation. Does Buddhism have a view of human nature that says we're flawed and need to accept and confess our limitations before we can find spiritual peace? So there's more in this passage we will revisit, but at first I thought it might be helpful to talk a little bit about the history of confession and contrition in Buddhism, because this started off from the very beginning of Buddhism, 2500 plus years ago. And the Buddha, during his lifetime, ended up making a lots and lots of rules governing the lives of monks and nuns. And it says that he only came up with these guidelines and rules as necessary. So as somebody did something, you're like, oh, that's probably not a good idea, then he made a rule. And so what it ended up is traditionally ordained monks have 227 rules governing their actions, and nuns have 311. They have more. Although, to be fair, some of those rules have to do with making sure that the monks can't take advantage of them and like make them do their laundry and stuff like that. So this is a little section from a article on the Access to Insight website called the Bhikkhu's Rules. The Bhikkhu is a name for this traditionally ordained monk, a guide for lay people. So it says the Buddha laid down that on the full and new moon days, so that's twice a month, all the bhikkhus in residence in the same community must come together in a formal meeting. If there is a quorum of at least four bhikkhus, they should listen to the full Patimokkha rule. So that's the whole list of their 227 rules. A competent bhikkhu who has learned this by heart will recite it in the Pali language for the community so they can remind themselves of their responsibilities in keeping the major 227 rules. The complete recitation may take anywhere from 35 minutes to an hour, depending on the skill of the reciting bhikkhu. Before the Patimokkha recitation begins, each bhikkhu should admit to any offenses that he knows he has committed by formally telling another monk, or more than one monk. Once this is accomplished, the monk is considered pure and can listen to the recitation of the rules. And the recitation includes questions asking if any bhikkhu present is guilty of the offenses. In many communities, it is normal for each bhikkhu to make a general confession of all possible offenses to another bhikkhu before listening to the recitation. So the offenses, there's a whole list of offenses as well, which are like this is something that you should confess if it's happened. And they are different, there's different levels of severity. If you confess this thing, then what happens? So there's four offenses, which means you're out of there. You're no longer a monk. And that is sexual intercourse, murder, major theft, or falsely claiming supernormal abilities. So you're claiming to, particularly to lay people, right? And you're like, oh, I got these special powers. That like you are stripped of your monkhood. Now there's many other offenses which are obviously less serious. They require a formal meeting of the community. The community will decide what happens, or say you are, the monk only is supposed to have so many personal possessions, and if he's hoarding possessions and he confesses that, he needs to give up those extra possessions, that kind of thing. Sometimes confession is enough, and some of the rules are just guidelines for training. They're just for the monk's own mindfulness practice. So just for a little taste, an example of rules entailing confession, the lying, insulting someone, divisive talebearing, sleeping in the same dwelling as a person of the opposite sex, because these are monks that have vows of celibacy, damaging a living plant, and complaining about the community. So this is, it's a very different style of practice from lay practice and from more modern monastic practice. So the confession here was very practical. In original Buddhism, morality is and was very pragmatic. The observation is selfishness, self-absorbed behavior, harmful behavior, lying, stealing, trying to get stuff for yourself, trying to take advantage of people, trying to escape the consequences of your actions, all of these things, indulging in desires and intoxicants, and these agitate the mind. They get you embroiled in karma, they cause disruption in your life, they cause disruption in the community, and so they're not compatible with deep spiritual practice. So it's like there's no God deciding what's right and wrong, who's watching us and judging us. It's just this very pragmatic observation that if you are practicing, right, if you are practicing as a monk or as a lay person, it is entirely voluntary. You said you wanted to do this. You said you wanted to do spiritual practice and calm the mind and awaken to certain truths and whatever. So Like, don't go do that stuff. That's not compatible with this training. So that's very pragmatic. And the confessions are similarly pragmatic in that if there's a lot of positive social support if you are accountable. You know, if you really had to confess on a regular basis, you know, the times you lost your temper and the times that you were just oblivious and not mindful and the times that you know, maybe overstated your opinion and, you know, ended up saying things that weren't, you know, pushing the edge of the truth and all the, if you had to, you know, regularly confess those to your fellow practitioners, you would probably become much more mindful of them. And then if you're trying to live a very specialized lifestyle like these monks were, it is essentially, well, I don't know about impossible, but I pretty close to impossible to live that way without the social support of others, without a community of people who is living that way. And I can speak to that, having been somebody who thought when I, in parts of my monastic practice, that, you know, a vow of celibacy would be just a, you know, a great addition to my practice. And trying to hold that all by yourself, surrounded by people who, for whom that is not a concern whatsoever, is very, very difficult. So that's where this comes from. It's all voluntary. And in addition, monks are warned against either pride or arrogance at how well they're keeping the rules, judgments about other people, about how they're not keeping the rules, a sense of superiority over, say, lay people who aren't keeping the Vinaya rules, and like, you know, look how holy I am. So actually, like, those kinds of attitudes are offenses worthy of confession. So it's built in there. So our guidelines for practice are 16 bodhisattva precepts, which are the three refuges, three pure precepts, and then do not kill or steal, misuse sexuality, don't lie, don't abuse intoxicants, don't dwell on or gossip about the mistakes of others, don't elevate oneself by criticizing others, do not be stingy, do not indulge anger, and do not defame the three treasures. So in our practice, this is the container and the guidelines for our training, saying if you want to do the practice, this, like, you pretty much have to do your best to live this way. Or, you know, if I like to think, you know, like the thief looks behind the door, right? If you're caught up in stuff like that, your zazen's going to be full of very disruptive things. So again, it's very, very practical. And the 16 bodhisattva precepts are something that our Dharma ancestor Zen Master Dogen in Japan, in he was lived in the 1200s. He started using those even for ordained monks. So ordained monks and lay people take the same precepts in our lineage from that point on. So we don't live according to all those, you know, 227 or the 311 rules, not even those of us who are ordained. Although if you do Zen monastic practice, you get some of that just by living in a monastic community. So a monastery will have its own rules and forms and stuff like that, which impose some of that simplicity and discipline. But those of us who don't live in a monastery have lived very different lives. So if you're curious, I do have a couple podcast episodes on the evolution of the precepts. That's 60 and 61 on my Zen Studies podcast, Taking Refuge and Precepts, The Significance of Becoming a Buddhist. I think I also have one on the like evolution of the Buddhist precepts as well. So Like the monastics who live according to the Vinaya, our way of training is voluntary. And the way we treat our precepts, including the act of contrition, is meant to be supportive of our aspirations. So this is never meant to be about looking at others or others looking at us and judging us to be bad or a failure, immoral, deficient, anything like that. We may look at others or ourselves and say, you know, killing and stealing and lying lead to suffering. And I hope you will find a way to end this behavior. And if you want some help with that, I'd be willing to share some of the Dharma with you. But that's a very, it's again, it's a very pragmatic thing. And this is what we mean by the great compassion of the Buddhas and Dharma ancestors. They don't hold the power of forgiveness. They don't hold any special power. They share with us this path. So that is their great compassion. A path of practice that helps us get out of the cycle of harmful and self-centered behaviors. And when we say, when we're confessing to harmful behaviors, it's not just egregious precept breaking, but habits of body, speech, and mind that are self-absorbed, negative, distracting, destructive. And many of us find, hopefully most of us, hopefully all of us find that practice allows us to become more aware of our behavior and to find new ways to be. And that it helps us unlike anything else has ever been able to help us. I came to practice when I was in my 20s and even at that young age managed to be quite neurotic and be caught up in dysfunctional relationship patterns. And I remember feeling just a great sense of despair that I couldn't do anything about that. I couldn't change that. I would kind of intend to, but then I would just get sucked back into the same patterns. And but then it was through practice, through Zazen, through the spaciousness that gives us, through mindfulness, through interacting with Sangha, through the Dharma teachings that it's, you know, as people have described sometimes, it's like some space opens up in your behavior and you can, okay, here's this now. And it's almost like you have a little bit more space to see what's happening, to consider what the different possibilities are, and to maybe act differently. So I found it very quickly transformed my life. But why is contrition necessary? Because we in our Kyoju Kaimon, this scripture about our precepts, we say this is the contrition is the gateway to our precepts. And the precepts are the prerequisite for spiritual training. So this is the gateway to everything. And I like to say this is admitting we have a problem. We can't change. We can't open up to a new way until we admit we have a problem. A contrite heart is open to the Dharma. If you, I mean, if you feel fine, your life is fine, and you don't want to make any changes, that's okay. I mean, that's your attitude. There's plenty of people out there in the world who have that attitude, and they're like, I don't, you know, I don't need spiritual practice or whatever. And you can't bring someone to that point, right? This is very typical of when we're talking about addictions, that if somebody as is struggling with an addiction, you can people around them can try to point that out and try to encourage them to face it or whatever, but it's until they make that choice to say, yes, I have something's awry and I want to fix it. Then, so that's what contrition is this Okay. But what are we confessing? What are we feeling contrite about? And essentially, this is about the experience of dukkha, dissatisfactoriness, or suffering. So this isn't an all or nothing thing. Sometimes dukkha is translated as suffering. So you might say, well, the gateway of contrition is to admit you're suffering. That means sometimes that definitely applies, but sometimes that is overstating the matter a little bit. It seems, I don't know about suffering. Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, right? But when you think about it in terms of admitting, just like the first step of the Four Noble Truths, recognizing dukkha in our lives, recognizing a sense of dissatisfactoriness, a sense that there's got to be something more than this, or we're not as free and compassionate as we would like to be. We're not as appreciative of our lives as we would like to be. We're more reactive, getting caught up in anger or fear more than we want to be. Those are the kinds of things which we can, this is what turns us toward the Dharma, is recognizing that we're experiencing some of those things. But we can, this is contrition, but we can experience contrition. We can admit we have a problem without any blame or shame. So this can be tricky. But it's all part of our practice. Like, it's naturally tricky. We engage this, we try to work on it. How do we even do this? This is part of what we're trying to learn. To take responsibility for our lives, for our karma, while also seeing through the delusion of the separate, independent, enduring, inherent self nature. So this cycle of suffering has no beginning. So that's one of the things our karma verse says, is this is beginningless. All my past and harmful karma. So karma, there's different ways to define it, but you might think this is behavioral cause and effect. There's many forms of cause and effect in the world, physical, chemical, genetic, da da da, and all of that affects us as well. But karma in particular is behavioral cause and effect. Classically, this is only our own behavior and our experience of the repercussions. But I think it's also helpful to think about the behavior of others, the behavior of our parents, the behavior of our ancestors, the behavior of people in our culture. This has an effect on us as well. So karma, this is all my past and harmful karma, isn't just what you have done. But it's stuff you might have inherited or just received from people before you or around you. And it doesn't matter whether you believe in rebirth or not. So traditionally, this is the idea, is that this stuff goes back lifetimes, and a choice you made three lifetimes ago might be affecting what's happening right now. You don't have to, whether or not you believe that, you can at least realize how every choice that you have made over the course of your life, as you get older, you realize these things add up, right? It seems like a small thing at first to dwell in this particular way in your mind, but then the groove gets deeper and deeper and deeper. So all of those choices add up. So here we are. Some of our karma is harmful. Some of it is diluted and not great. But then we say it's born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. Greed, hate, and delusion are the three poisons that are behind all harmful action. We say we can't trace the causes and conditions back to the beginning. And that's not what our contrition is about. That's not generally what Zen practice is about. There's a time and a place for reflecting on your past, for therapy, for, kind of trying to untangle some of the karmic threads that affect you. But in practice, we're really like, okay, here I am. I ended up like this. I like to call it like it's your karmic package or it's your karmic soup. You made those decisions in the past. There's no going back to change them. So here we are. This is your karmic package, like it or not. And some of us, we like a little of it, and there's a lot of it we don't like. And all of this karma is born through body, speech, and mind. So this flow of karma, this flow of causes and conditions, it continues because of our participation. We perpetuate it through our body, speech, and mind. So unless we take responsibility for it, it's gonna can just kind of continue. Unless we make a conscious choice about how we want to move forward. And then I now fully avow. I like to say I face it, I acknowledge it, I take responsibility for it. The buck stops here. However, I ended up like this. Genetics, chance, nurture, choices, culture, here I am. An imperfect being with a delusion of inherent self nature and countless harmful habits of body, speech, and mind. What now? So contrition brings freedom and immaculacy if we can manage not to get caught in self-blame. This is freedom and immaculacy. We start where we are with no apologies. Now, we may make apologies for past actions in order to, heal some hurts or amend wrongs or something like that. Not that kind of apology. We're not apologizing for being who and what we are. We're not apologizing for being an imperfect sentient being with a whole bunch of karma. Which is why that passage says we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and make this act of contrition wholeheartedly. So I always love that image. Just like, all right, I'm going to take responsibility. I'm not going to whine. I'm not going to make excuses. I'm not going to complain. I'm not going to assign blame, even blame for myself. We're holding this up. I would say wrong, but in a way that it's not intended to be held. If we have a sense of like, oh yeah, I just suck. I mean, the moment we have that sense, then essentially we are dreaming up a enduring self nature, which is stained and stained with sin and stuck in some way. So the gateway of contrition involves radical acceptance of who and what we are, but also without dwelling on it, we move on. So that's why in the precept scripture, right, the contrition is the gateway. Now we take refuge in the precepts and we start to practice. Right? We move forward. Periodically, we recite this verse again to remind ourselves that we're not there yet, to take responsibility, to maintain humility, but then we move on. So I liked atone means to make amends for or expiate. Although an obsolete definition I like is to bring into unity, harmony, concord. And some synonyms are to correct, appease, absolve, answer, redeem, balance, or repair. And avow means to declare openly and frankly. to acknowledge, admit, affirm, allow, concede, or confess. So I'm perfectly at noon. We have 15 minutes left, and let's open it up for comments or questions, and feel free to share your own experience with or relationship to contrition as well. So if you're in the cloud, go ahead and raise your hand, and if you're in the Zendo, just come and sit in the questioner chair, and I will call on you when the time comes.
Probably okay to speak
there
for an
go.
Hour.
There's a question.
James is in the questioner chair.
I have a lot of questions, but not on this.
Oh, is she talking?
Did you lose something?
Yeah, we have a baby.
Oh, that's the...
Anybody have a negative reaction to the idea of contrition? Christina! Paulette!
Oh, yeah, hi. Yes, I really do. You know, when I went to the Great Vow this summer and had the week-long retreat, we recited this numerous times, and I think I very casually mentioned to you, oh, there was a lot of ritual going on, but honestly, it was this verse. My takeaway was, I felt it was like a deal breaker for me to become a Buddhist, because it just made me so pissed, honestly, because it isn't my perception of how we approach Buddhism. And so I just want to tell you how much I appreciated your comments today, because you really talked me off a ledge. I really like the way you went through it line by line and with a lot of detail, because even about halfway through, I was like, yeah, right, you know. I think you really helped me see this in a new way. So I just want to thank you heartily, because I just, for me, this was a real stumbling block, this particular chant or verse. So thank you very much.
And do you mind saying something about, like, why you feel negatively about it?
Well, because of my background, one of the many reasons I stepped away from Christianity was, one, I didn't believe it, but also because it seemed to be so focused on sin. And being introduced to Christianity when I was a kid, it just felt like a little bit of overkill. So to me, these verses feel like a sledgehammer. Mm. Just contrary to how I've been introduced to Buddhism. So it just felt really out of sync, and more like some of some aspects of Christianity that I didn't really care for. So just to be oversharing, yeah, just a bit.
Yeah, well, it makes me think about how in my most recent podcast episode, I mentioned that Roshi Kennett had it set up so that, you know, people wouldn't just kind of come in off the street and recite the Bodhisattva vows, not knowing what on earth it was. Kind of occurs to me that a similar thing should probably be done with the karma verse, you know, if you just show up for the first time and then you're like, oh, my past and what? I don't know. It's tough because, like, you know, where would we do it then if we didn't, you know, do it on our chanting service? And yet, it's true.
Yeah, and just as a final comment, there is a fair amount of ritual and in the Buddhist practice, at least as I experienced at Great Vow. And there is a lot of chanting. And for those of us who are just kind of wandering in, it really is helpful to have some more background and perspective about it. So I really appreciate that.
And I think, you know, on a related note, one of my favorite things about Buddhism is especially Mahayana Buddhism, is the view that our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. That it's like we're clouded by stuff that causes suffering. And it's seeing that and letting go of that that lets us become our, you know, what we're meant to be. And so it's kind of a flip side view, a flipped view of the, not all forms of Christianity, but especially, you know, Catholicism and stuff, which is like, you have sin, you are a sinner to begin with, and then you need redemption, as opposed to.
Yeah, I think you're bringing up a good point, because vocabulary for me can be very triggering. And I think there is a big difference for me between the sense of contrition and the sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I'm all about being responsible, but that whole contrition center piece triggers me, as you can tell by my comments today.
I think for me, even though I share the same skepticism and like, I think there's a, for me, contrition points to a valuable, sweet piece that's maybe just a stage or a component where we really just do feel sorry. We really do feel regret. You know, and we shouldn't stay there and dwell on the past, right? It's beginningless, whatever. But there is a moment of you know, looking at how we've been living or whatever and going, you don't want to do that.
You know, see, for me, I would, instead of feeling sorry, I just feel sad, because it's more a matter of being ignorant to me than being bad. I guess where I'm coming from.
Yeah. So I think you're right. I think we could say sad, not.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I don't, you can see I hold grudges, I guess. But anyway, I just really appreciated your comments today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your honesty about your response.
Yeah. Thank you.
Paulette, did you still have something?
Yeah. I appreciate your talk. Thank you. I do feel like sometimes when we talk about feeling sorry or contrition, it's like a little bit of walking a tightrope, like, oops, you know, like I'm gonna make a mistake. And then, and that was part of the reason why I moved away from Christianity, because I had both of them in my upbringing, Buddhism and Christianity. And I felt like it was too easy to make, you know, to make a mistake or fall off the path or whatever when it came to the Christian side of things. You know, I like them both. I respect them both. My question though was just about like the idea that there's no, you can't trace a beginning to karma. And for me, that's a hard one to kind of wrap my brain around, because I feel like that doesn't really make sense. Like there's, if you could like maybe expand upon that a little bit.
Well, I mean, but you believe in rebirth, so why doesn't it make sense to you?
Because I feel like there has to be a beginning to it. you know, there's got to be some start to when things, you know, came into fruition. And
yeah, I mean, I guess I'm reminded of, you know, there's a passage in the Pali Canon where the Buddha talks about like five different things that if you contemplate them, you'll just go crazy. And one of them is like tracing karma back. And so I think it's treated as one of those questions that do not tend to edification. Even though we may be curious, like, how did it all begin? Like, why is it like this? Greed, hate, and delusion, where did they come from? Why are they there? Like, even though it's kind of interesting, I think the Buddha said, like, don't waste your time. We can't figure that out, so let's just get to work. Which can be a little unsatisfying that it doesn't explain that, but that, I guess when I think of it in my terms, you know, I don't have to necessarily, you can't prove beginningless, right? That's like, you can't kind of prove a negative. But when I think about, okay, I have a tendency toward impatience and irrational rages as I go about my day, and this little thing goes wrong, and then I just, like, you know, I'll swear or throw something. And like, what is that? And why am I like that? I mean, I'm like that because of all the times that I have indulged that habit in the past. But then you look at little kids and you're like, some of them are as mellow as can be, and some of them get really, really mad, and some of them, you know, have tantrums, and some of them, why are they like that? This isn't because of the choices they made in the womb, you know? So what is it? I mean, and it's genetics. We know a lot of it is genetics. It's this kind of chance. It's, you know, nurture. It's how your parents were raised. But there's so many things that feed into how we end up, that I feel like that what it's pointing to is just this sense of, I'm not going to waste my time trying to figure out where this came from. I'm just going to deal with it now. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
By the way, we're not standing on the beginningless claim. We're just saying we're not going to try to figure out. Because, you know, I think, you know, we all fall into this, but sometimes it's easier to notice it in other people. You know, or other people they have negative behaviors, they have troubles in their lives, but there's other people to blame. Or there's themselves to blame, right? Then I'm a terrible person, or I did this thing in the past, and I should never have done that. And, you know, and then it's like, as long as there's that blame, as long as there's that effort to lay the blame, you know, my parents were so terrible to me. That may be so. That may be very true. But at this point, like, laying the blame is not really going to get us any further on the path. Couple minutes left. One last question. Comment? Ruthann, you have anything, Ruthann?
Oh, yes, briefly. I studied the Course in Miracles some years before I took up Buddhism, and they clearly repeat, if you let your thoughts run your life, that's sheer ignorance. They make no bones about that. And we all have the heritage we were given at birth. And I know for myself, I said to my friend who grew up Southern Baptist, I said, how can a heritage produce Chopin and Marie Curie and be some of the most prejudiced white people on the planet. And she had her grumble from her heritage. So I'll just end with the joke that brought my Chinese friends some comfort. If Adam and Eve were Chinese, they would have eaten the snake and we wouldn't have the drama. So, sorry for that. Thank you for the talk. It was helpful.
Thank you, Ruthann. Oh, all right. Let's say our closing words. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout
space and time.
All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone.